in Delaware Township, 90.5 WPNJ in Easton.
Driving into town with the dark cloud above you, dialing the number who's bound to love you. Oh, honey, you turn me on, and the radio.
This is Carl Multer from Into the Garden. Like a garden that does better when it is tended, your station will thrive with listener care. Please consider making a donation today to keep WDVR green and growing.
WDVR thanks Kevin Boyd of Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Fox and Roach Realtors in Doylestown, Pennsylvania, for his support. Kevin has over 20 years of experience in the Delaware Valley, assisting clients in marketing and finding their new homes. Kevin Boyd can be reached in the office at 215-348-1700 or on his cell at 484-437-5394. Online, it's kevinboyd.foxroach.com.
WDVR is supported by the Surgeonsville Inn, now offering monthly Wines Around the World dinners. On May 19th, there will be a five-course tasting dinner featuring food and wine from the West Coast. Also, the Inn has opened its Ice House Wine Shop with an array of fine wines and liquor selections. The phone number for the Inn is 609-397-3700 and online at surgeonsvilleinn.com and on Instagram at surgeonsvilleinn.
Subscribe to WDVR's monthly email newsletter and you'll be able to preview upcoming features, guests, and events. And read articles written by WDVR volunteers. Go to WDVRFM.org and sign up today.
The River of Life Church provides food and other clothing distribution every other Saturday for those in need. The pickup location is 445 South Main Street in Phillipsburg, New Jersey, from 10 a.m. to noon. For a schedule of distribution dates, or if you would like to donate non-perishable food items, please call 908-213-1377. Clothing donations are not being accepted at this time.
Hi, this is Shep Cohen, host of The World of Work on WDVR. I'm on every Friday from 4 to 5 when I interview guests from all walks of life, people with big jobs and small, from laborers and the homeless to CEOs and Academy Award winners. I bring to you people who are trying to make a difference in the world, but whose voices are not normally heard. Join me Fridays for interesting and provocative conversations.
any desk I've ever.
You're ready to go. We can hang up if you tell
me. I'm just going to give me 1 second. I'm going to get rid of and.
You're on mic right now.
Okay. This is The World of Work. I'm your host, Shep Cohen. I had a little technical difficulty getting online, but Gene helped me out, and we're on the air. And my guest today is Bruce. Pronounce your last name. I knew I was going to have a problem.
Leyendyke.
Bruce Leyendyke, and he is the author of Mighty Bad Land, The Perilous Expedition to Antarctica Reveals Clues to an Eighth Continent. And he spent a number of months in Antarctica, and he's going to talk about that this afternoon. He did it a number of times. He was a professor in California, did it as part of a grant from the National Science Foundation. And he's here today to talk about his book. Bruce, how did you get interested in Antarctica?
Yeah, first got into my consciousness when I was a kid. I was getting, my parents subscribed to the National Geographic. And then during the late 50s, there was a massive exploration of Antarctica by mostly by the U.S. Navy and an international team under the umbrella of something called the International Geophysical Gear. So I get the magazines and I browse through them and mostly look at the colored pictures. I think I was 9 or something at the time. It just seemed like fascinating to me and so remote, so alone, so challenging, and probably something I didn't want to do. But then, a few years later, I was in college, and I worked for an outfit in San Diego called the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. It's part of the UC San Diego. And I had dropped out of college to go on a deep-sea expedition to the Western Pacific. And I had a supervisor who was a marine technician, a person who does the nuts and bolts stuff, and I was supposed to be his assistant. And he reluctantly took me under his wing, but he was really skeptical of my my contributions and my abilities because I was only 19. And most of the staff crew were ex-Navy, retired Navy folks, plus PhD scientists. So I was kind of a whippersnapper outlier. But nevertheless, this man's name was George, and we had lunch with him and a couple of his Navy buddies every so often down by the beach. And he started talking about books he had read. And he mentioned this book, Hunter, about hunting in Africa, and how much he liked that book. And I said, oh yeah, I read that book too. And he said, what do you mean you read that book, you little punk? Where would you find that book? And I said, wisely said nothing. And then he said, I'm reading Shackleton's book right now, South. And I said, Shackleton, who's he? And that really ticked him off, plus the other two guys who were at the table. You don't know who Shackleton is, and you're going to college. What have you been doing? And then he starts telling me the story about Shackleton and then the Ernest Shackleton and him being marooned on the Antarctic Peninsula and how he saved all of his men and sailed across the Drake Passage and then ultimately rescued them months later. And I said, I can't believe that. Well, you ought to read this book and learn something about courage. And then by accident, when I was a professor at UC Santa Barbara, I was browsing the library and I stumbled on that book, South, by Shackleton. I remembered the conversation I had had when I was a 19-year-old, and I read that book. And I was just stunned by the scale of the expedition, just nerve, the people involved, and the teamwork, and how they all pulled through, and how Shackleton led them. And that just convinced me, like, this is a place, this is a life-changing place. If I ever get a chance, then I'm going to go to Antarctica.
Once you decide that you want to go to Antarctica and you want to do scientific work there, how do you go about making that a real reality? It's one thing reading a book and being interested, and another thing taking it the next step and actually going on an expedition to Antarctica. I mean, what were the nuts and bolts? How did you go around? Who funded you? How'd you get your crew together? Let us know that.
Sure. So what happened after reading that book, I got connected with people who were working, doing geology in New Zealand, and I partnered with a guy, Dave, and we started a project in the South Island of New Zealand in the Southern Alps there. And we were musing one time how difficult it was to work in New Zealand, where it was raining a lot and the rocks were crumbling because they were being weathered into pieces and you couldn't get to them, and they were really very unique. And then Dave says, you know, I think I heard about this or mountain range just like this in Antarctica, but it hasn't been explored. And it might provide clues and evidence that New Zealand and that part of Antarctica were once joined up. So we said, well, let's go there. So right. We're having dinner and we decided, well, let's go there. Well, now to answer your question, how do you do that? Well, you got to put together a proposal to the National Science Foundation, because they control all access to Antarctica. And you outline your objectives and how are you going to do it and how much it's going to cost and who the people are going to do it. And so Dave and I did that, and we pitched our proposal. You get two chances, one chance a year to do it. First time we did it, it got rejected. And they give you feedback as to why it was rejected, because it gets rejected by peers. So you have some pretty smart people giving you smart reasons why it's rejected. And then we submitted it again. And then the second time, we got funded. So that meant we had a green light. And that was 2 years after we thought about it. And then the expedition was planned for a year after that. So the whole thing was taking like 3 years to, you know, get it off the ground. Then we had to get people, as you asked. How do you get the people? So the deal is, where we were going to go to do this project was in the wilderness of Antarctica. It was not near any of the stations. So we had to have, NSF required us that we had a minimum of 6 people, two of which had to be alpinists or mountain guides. Didn't necessarily have been to Antarctica, but they knew how to handle themselves in that kind of those kind of challenging situations. And then I had a graduate student. That's another very interesting story of how I ended up with her. You can ask me it later if you like. And then we had another a colleague of Dave's. So eventually we put together the 6 people, and then we had a start date, and we were ready to go. We were ready to launch from Santa Barbara.
Did you have to come up with, when you made your application to the National Science Foundation, did you have to present them with a purpose for your expedition?
Absolutely. There's two approaches to take when you're trying to raise money at the National Science Foundation. One is you have a really good, strong question, and you're proposing a way that you think you can solve it. And the other way is to convince the reviewers at the foundation that there's nothing really known about this topic, so let's go take a look and see what we can find out about this topic. We took a combination of the two. Our hypothesis was, this particular area of an area called Marie Birdland on the Pacific coast of Antarctica was once welded up with New Zealand in the giant supercontinent of Gondwana. And we wanted to see parallels of the geology in Antarctica, Marie Birdland, and New Zealand. Sort of like the other half of the torn newspaper, you know, where you got a print in the newspaper, you rip it in part, and you get a sentence that ends in one piece and then it starts again at the other piece. So that kind of strategy. And so that was our hypothesis. And if we could show that we had a matchup, then we could start to put together the history of the opening of the South Pacific Ocean and the ocean around Antarctica. So that's what we pitched, to go there and to find the other half of the torn newspaper.
When they rejected your application the first time, did they come back with reasoning, telling you why, or did you just get a letter, no thanks?
Both. First thing you get is a form letter. It's the first sentence is, "We regret to inform you," and then they go a couple of paragraphs of boilerplate. But all research proposals to the National Science Foundation go out for peer review and panel review. So the proposal we sent out went out to like probably six scientists, experts, to give judgments on it. And those results from that review went to the panel that NSF convenes to look at these proposals. And then they take that into account to make a decision, yes or no. But you get to see the reviews, you get to see the criticisms, and you get to see to decide whether you can address the criticisms or not and take a second try. I don't remember exactly what the first criticisms were. Probably something like, who are these guys? They've never been there before. Why should we spend a bunch of money and et cetera, so forth on these people? You know, we were young greenhorns. So I think that was a lot of it. We didn't have a signature leader on the team who had a track record.
Did the University of California give you a hard time at all, or they gave you a leave of absence? What was your status when you were away for those months?
Right. Okay, so, yeah. I was a professor. Dave was a research scientist. Steve was a research scientist. Christine was my graduate student. And then the mountaineering guys, the two of those folks we hired on the grant. So when I took a sabbatical leave, and took my graduate student with me so that she could get started on her dissertation. So all that checked the boxes of the university as to this is a go.
And your graduate student, was there a story there that she got involved, or just?
Yeah. Every time I think about this, it's 30 years ago, but I'm laughing about it. We found out we got the notification from NSF that we got funded, and Dave and I said, well, we need a graduate student. This is a perfect opportunity for a really knockout project. So I put out, before email, you know, so I wrote up a memo describing what we were going to do. And then I had the secretarial staff put them in the mailboxes of all the graduate students that we had. There were like 60 graduate students, I think. And I swear, the ink wasn't even wet. I mean, it wasn't even dry before I got pounding on my door by this woman who looked like she was on the track team, wanting to get into my office and talk to me about this project. And she just came in and started telling me about herself, like she'd just come from the University of Arizona and she had done a project on rocks and mountain ranges like this in Arizona. She had grown up on a dairy farm and used to milk the cows at dawn, and you know, stories like that. And just felt like this is really great synchronicity and serendipity, is perfect fit. And it was the first student that knocked on my door. So she's in.
Once you're approved, you have your sabbatical, what do you do in preparation other than what we've talked about? How do you get ready to go on an expedition to Antarctica?
So the NSF has its own division for polar sciences and Antarctica, and they have their own contractors. At the time, the contractors were, I think they were ITT, Antarctic Support Associates, and these are the staffers who start you addressing exactly what you asked. So they visited us and had meetings with us in Santa Barbara with their 100-page checklists of what we needed to make sure we did, what we needed to make sure we requested, and didn't leave any stone unturned, because when you're out there in the wilderness by yourself, six people, you have to bring your own paper clips. I mean, there's nothing. There's nothing there. You're not getting resupplied. And the other thing you have to do is pass really stringent medical and dental examinations. And matter of fact, the package for that, each of those are like 60 pages of questions and going to doctors and getting these exams and this lab test and checked off for your health. And if you got impacted wisdom teeth, make sure you have them pulled, because you're not going if you don't have them pulled. What happened to me, as I explained in my book, Mighty Badland, in the second chapter, is I checked off that I had asthma. And I got a result back that said I wasn't qualified, that I couldn't go.
Whoa, after all that.
After all that. And I, of course, fell off my chair when I saw that. And I started digging into it. I mean, every no, there's a way to ask how come and do something about it. So what they told me to do was, okay, go to this laboratory, this pulmonology lab, and get what's called the cold air exercise challenge, to show you can do hard work in conditions like Antarctica. And this is a chapter in my book, second chapter. So what they did to me, should I tell you? Can I tell you what they
did
to me?
Yes, go ahead.
So,
please.
I go into this this lab room. There's a couple of white coat doctors in there and some instruments. And they tell me how to prepare. So I've got on shorts and tennis shoes and nothing else. And they shave my chest and they put these, you know, glue these electrodes to you, like you get when you do a treadmill, stuff like that. And then they put me on a bicycle, and then they clipped my nose shut, and they shoved a tube into my mouth, which was coming out at 0 degrees centigrade, freezing. And then they said, okay, now you're going to pedal up to your maximum heart rate, which was 150, or maybe is that the maximum or the exercise maximum? I don't know what it was. He said, you're going to pedal up to that rate, and you're going to keep it there, up there for 12 minutes or 7 minutes or whatever it was. I wrote it down in the book, but I don't remember how long it was. But I pedaled, breathing that frozen air. Then, you know, before I passed out, got off the bike, sat down in the chair, and then had to, every few minutes, puff out through another device as hard as I could, and they were measuring my response to the exercise in the frozen air. I actually passed that. So what it proved was, even though I have asthma, which comes up in the book, my book, Mighty Badland, I don't have cold air exercise induced asthma. That's what I don't have. I didn't have. So that got me cleared by doing that.
So you go through all these tests, and you're ready to go. How do you get there? I know you can't take a train there, or United Airlines doesn't run a regular flight out to Antarctica. So how do you put together the various steps to get there?
Yeah, once you're approved, once your project is green-lighted, through the medicals, and you've done all the dentals, and you've done all the support forms of supplies and stuff, you then get scheduled on a flight, commercial flight. So the commercial flight airline takes you to Christchurch, New Zealand. And that's where the NSF has what's called the U.S. Antarctic Program Clothing Distribution Center. That's where you get started by getting your outfitted with your gear and you get put on a flight schedule. And the next step is to then get on a military flight from Christchurch down to McMurdo Station, Antarctica. That's 2,500 miles south. So the military is either the, at the time, was either the U.S. Navy or the New Zealand Air Force. Either one of those. But they were both flying Hercules, C-130s. Everybody's seen those aircraft. They're on the news all the time. And like these gigantic buses with four turboprop engines, and they have a tailgate that flaps down on the back. They've been on the news all the time. So what we did, we got all ready to go, got all of our gear, and we're ready to go on the military flight. Of course, the weather isn't any good in McMurdo, so we have to wait. So we wait a week until we suit up four times, go to the airport. The flight gets scratched, and come back, the flight gets scratched. So eventually you get on a flight to McMurdo Station from Christchurch on military aircraft. And the reason they scratch these flights is because the weather's terrible in McMurdo. And they don't have any instrument landing. It's all visual flight. So you have to be able to see where you're going, and the weather has to be acceptable to land. And so 8 hours later, sitting in this cramped aircraft, you land. And what we did was we landed on the sea ice. The McMurdo Sound is frozen every winter. And it's about 6 feet or more of ice, and the Navy builds an airfield on it. So we landed on that floating sea ice, and then taken from there into briefings and quarters and getting ready for the next phase. So when you're in McMurdo, I can tell you the story of what happens in McMurdo, but you ask how do you get there. I'm not done yet. How do you get there? Because we had to go out to Marie Birdland. We're in McMurdo. Marie Birdland is 800 miles from McMurdo. It's like, you know, from New York to Chicago. How do you get there? You're in New York, so you got to go to Chicago, and there's nothing out in Chicago. So we wait again for the weather to clear in wherever we're going. They do that remotely through satellite because nobody's there. And then they load you up into another Hercules that has skis on it. With all your gear, thousands of pounds of gear, and then you're flown out there, and you ski down to the snow, and you stop, they drop the tailgate, and shove all your gear off, put up your tents, start a stove, get the radio contact with McMurdo, and they fly away, and you're there. So that's the answer to how you get there.
what year was this? We haven't talked about that.
You're right. This first exhibition was 1989-90. And the last time I went to Antarctica was in 2010-2011. I've been there nine times. And the first two times I went were these deep field wilderness expeditions. And then the third time I went with the German expedition that was also deep field. Then I made several marine geology trips on icebreakers offshore. I was an expedition leader on three of those. And then we did, following expeditions I did were geophysical instrumentation experiments on the continent. Not like these first ones where you're really an explorer and you're making maps, collecting samples, and living on your own in the middle of aloneness.
When you got there and they left you there, did you say or think to yourself, "Oh, this is what I wanted," or "What I get my," or did you say to yourself, "What did I get myself into"?
I said, "I'm trying to find out where I wrote it down." Let's see.
While you're doing that, we're speaking with Bruce Lewandyke, who is the author of Mighty Bad Land, The Perilous Expedition to Antarctica Reveals Clues to an Eighth Continent. And this is The World of Work, and I'm your host, Shep Cohen, and we're listening to The World of Work and on WDVR-FM. Okay, Bruce.
So what did I think?
Yes.
Oh, so the apprehensions invaded my psyche many times during the whole process of, like, really, I'm going to live in a tent out there 800 miles from anybody in Antarctica, of all places? You know, when I'm in California, I'm thinking this. And then I forget about it. And then I get all excited and get going. And then I think about, wait a minute, haven't people died there? Then I forget about it and I keep on going. But when they left us there, and they flew away, they left us here, and I watched them fly into the sky, and so I couldn't see the speck of them anymore or their brown exhaust. I felt, this is what I said to myself, something's going to happen. I don't know what. We're about to discover, to create new knowledge. How great is that?
So you did take the positive perspective.
Yeah, I spent 3 years. So, yeah. I mean, how great. Who gets to do that? Really?
Yeah, that must have been very exciting. And you said that you would live in a tent. One person per tent, or your first go around, or did you share a tent with someone?
There's two people in a tent. I wrote some words about that. I wonder if I have.
We're speaking with.
Doesn't matter. I can tell you. I'm going to tell
you. Bruce Lowendyke. Yes.
I'll tell you what it's like living it. Well, first of all, there's two people in a special kind of tent. It's called a Scott Polar tent. And it's a big, heavy duty deal. It's pyramid shaped, got four sides, and each side has a pole. They meet at an apex, a top, so there's no center to it. And then it's got it sits on like a box shape of on the bottom of the tent. So, and it's 8 feet by 8 feet, and it sits on the snow. So there's no floor. There's four tent poles. They're 2-inch thick wood. I forget what kind of wood it is. And sitting on the snow, and then you're staking it down, and has something called a skirt, which is about, which sticks out from the tent on the snow, a couple of feet all around it, and you nail that down with stakes, and then it's got guy ropes, you know, on two on each side that you pull and tighten. So that's the way you set it up, and then you put in a tarp for the floor. Then you put in some Insulite pads, and we had sheepskins. And then you put on over that, you put your sleeping bags. And then down, so there's two people in there. So Dave's on one side and I'm on the other side. Then between us, we have wooden boxes that have food and cooking pots and a small shelf for a one burner stove, an Optimus stove. And to get into the tent, there's a canvas tunnel. That's about 3 feet wide. It's a floppy tunnel that you're going to tie off in a storm, and you crawl through that to get into the tent. And at the top of the tent, there's an exhaust, very tippity top. There's an exhaust hole that you put a rubber gasket in for fumes from the stove. So there's no view unless you leave the tent open, which we did one time by mistake, and got snow in a tent. And there's no heat. It's got a inner liner, which gives you some insulation, but I never recorded the temperature inside that tent, even after cooking a lot, above 50 Fahrenheit. So you always have to have clothes on living in the tent, that's for starters, so you're never naked.
And always you have one layer after another? You dress in layers?
Well, the dressing layers. There's the next to the skin layer. which is usually capelline or propylene for people who know what those things are. Then over that, there's a fleece layer. Then over that, there's a windbreaker layer. Then there's wind pants that go over that. And then there's a parka that goes over that. And then on your hands, you have liners. And then you put a robust ski gloves over those liners. And if it gets really nasty, you put giant mittens over the gloves.
Were you ever warm, or were you constantly chilled?
I'd say that I only was cold a couple times. When we were working, we would be down to our windbreaker weathers, what layers, because we'd be either hiking or climbing or shoveling or digging or hammering or something, where you'd be generating body heat, but I don't ever remember sweating. I do remember that since you're always weight and space limited, that we didn't take lots of changes of underwear. So what we would do is wear the underwear for like a week, then turn it inside out and wear it inside out for another week, and then get another pair of long johns and wear them a week, and then inside out for a week, and et cetera, so forth. So we never had laundry. We only took sponge baths, except on a couple of rare occasions. And
in spite of that, your body odor, I think you mentioned in your book, was not offensive.
Yeah, because you're basically so cool that the bacteria that cause body odor either don't exist or they're not growing, or I don't know. And we did take sponge baths, of course. But we didn't have body odor. No, I don't remember that part at all. So it wasn't that objectionable. But you never took clothes off for very long, except to change.
Now, you didn't have any fresh food. What'd you bring? A lot of cans?
We brought three different things. We brought some canned food, but not a lot, because that's really heavy. And weight matters when you're in an aircraft deployment. We brought dehydrated food, freeze-dried stuff. And then we did bring some frozen food, but we didn't bring anything fresh. Matter of fact, in the whole of Antarctic program, even at McMurdo Station, there's no fresh food, except that when it comes with a flight from the Christchurch, and wasn't very frequent when I was there. So fresh food is not very, if you don't have it in the field, it's rare in McMurdo Station. And the frozen food, we'd actually had to create a locker, dig a hole in the snow to keep the frozen food frozen, because even at 50 degrees, if it's in your tent, some of it's going to start melting. So we actually had to freeze our frozen food.
And you also,
concept I hadn't anticipated.
You also had a whole procedure for going to the bathroom.
Yeah, there's protocols on that. So for number one, we would have our own pee bottles, and we drew a skull and crossbones on those, so we didn't mix them up with anything else. So you'd fill that up, and then right by the exit to the tent, you'd melt a hole, a few inches in diameter, and you emptied number one down that hole, which you crawl over when you go in and out of the tent. And then number two, you got to do outside. And this first expedition, we did not have a tent to do that. So we had to build windbreak, snowblock windbreaks. or in one famous episode I recount in my book, Mighty Badland. I had to call the nature before we had put up the snowblock wall. I had to go out in a blizzard and drop my pants and get to work. And then the protocol is all number two is collected and put in 5-gallon buckets and brought back to McMurdo for disposal. You don't leave any human waste in the field.
What was the temperature normally while you were there for those 3-4 months?
Yeah, about 20 degrees Fahrenheit was a good day. That was a good average day where you were grateful. We were fairly close to the ocean, the open ocean. We couldn't see it, but we knew it was maybe 50 miles away. So that moderated our temperatures, but of course made it stormier. So 20 degrees for weeks, that gets old. And if any wind starts moving, then you've got wind chill. And I think everybody who lives in New Jersey knows about wind chill.
Yes, absolutely.
So all you need is a tiny breeze, and 20 degrees hurts. So, yeah, we had wind chills, but I think I calculated once, what was it, minus 20, minus 40, I don't remember. I wrote it down in the book, one chapter. But, yeah, and it was windy most of the time. So you're mostly dealing with wind chill.
Is there any excerpt that you'd like to read from the book? And we're speaking with Bruce Lewandijk, author of Mighty Bad Land. Yes. Which section?
I'm going to read the part where Mighty Bad Land is defined. So this is chapter 4 where we're first arriving in McMurdo and getting oriented, and I'm wandering around town right at midnight, and of course the sun's out because the sun's not setting. And I wander around the dirt tracks of the town, and I notice at the end of this road there's a chapel like you see in New England, but it's like shrunken down, like, you know, 5/8 scale, like Disneyland or something. So I wander down to this chapel, and doors open, nobody's in there, and I just come from one of the bars. I felt like exploring, and I went in there, and there was a coffee pot on. And I went over the coffee pot, and the coffee pot was in front of this window that looked over McMurdo Sound, which is at borders of McMurdo Station, and across west from the station, across the frozen McMurdo Sound, are the Transantarctic Mountains, these massive, gorgeous mountains that are 12,000 feet high. They just sprout out of the ocean, out of the frozen sound. And I started to go into this like trance when I was looking at them. And this is what I wrote about that incident. I'm standing there, drinking my coffee, staring across 20 miles of ice up at these gigantic white mountains. I imagined what it would be like to stand on those mountaintops, to view the infinity of ice beyond them, the excitement of that, the aloneness. The longer I stared at the range, the more my imagination worked. I saw the peaks as members of a pride of white lions. They crouched at rest. They faced me, sphinx-like, guarded the colossus of the interior. They dared me to enter. And that was a moment I started to feel like, this is serious. Then, shortly afterwards, I thought back to when I got a call from NSF that told me, when I was at Santa Barbara, that told me we got our project approved and funded. And the NSF official was talking to me, and he's kind of like trying to calibrate me before I actually, you know, sign on the dotted line and take the green light. So he's talking, "You'll be way out there. No rescue by helicopters. Too far. You're on your own." He waited a few seconds for that message to set in. "Murray Birdland has a nickname. You've heard it, right? Mighty Badland."
Oh. What was a typical day like, if there was one?
Typical day, in the tents, out in the field, yeah.
Either way.
And the first thing you ask yourself when you wake up is, what's the weather like outside? I mean, are we in a blizzard? Usually you know when you're a blizzard because the tent is rattling and snapping like a rifle shots. Is the sun out? Can we work? So, you know, you stick your head out through the tunnel, untie it, and check it out. And you take the temperature and the wind and record that. And then you get on the radio and you call back to McMurdo Station and you give them the weather report, which is the basically temperature, wind speed, and direction barometer. And then you decide what you're going to eat, which usually was oatmeal, instant oatmeal, which yeah. I still eat.
You still eat?
Yeah.
I that was me. I think I wouldn't touch it again.
Every time I fire it up and cook it, it takes me back. You know, it's one of those smells.
Okay.
Smell connections, yeah. So then after your, well, where Dave and I would eating our oatmeal and our hot tang, we start talking, refreshing ourselves on the plan for the day and making a plan to talk to the other folks in the other tents. And usually by the time we've seen them the night before, we have a plan for the next day if the weather's okay. So, you know, after breakfast, you clean up a little bit, put on all your clothes, gather up the people and your snowmobiles, and go on your mission for the day. Take your food with you for lunch, make your water, take your ropes, all your climbing gear, and get going.
How far from the tents did you go out?
Well, it depends on the objective. Most of the time, I would say we would work within the radius of 5 miles or so. But at times, we went out 20 miles.
How would you know how to get back?
Well, you have to follow your tracks, and hopefully the tracks are not blown away. Yeah. We did not have GPSs, and we did not have walkie-talkies.
Well, if you had a GPS, I don't think it would work out there, would it?
Well, these days they do, yeah.
They do work, huh? But you didn't have them, so that's very interesting.
No, this project, this timing of this, the late 80s, the 1990s, was before the internet really established itself throughout Antarctica. So we didn't have internet, we didn't have satellite phones, and we didn't have GPSs. And even at McMurdo Station, there was no internet.
So it was relatively primitive.
Yeah, it was relatively primitive. I made a couple of phone calls home when I was at McMurdo, but then I had to go over the mountain to the New Zealand base, Scott base, because those are the ones that had phones that we could use. And they could patch us through to the States.
When you were there, how many hours of the day were sunlight?
24.
24, okay. So it was 24 all, okay.
Yeah. So that's when I got started. Two things that I still have as my sleeping equipment. One is eye shades, and the other is earplugs. So I still sleep with eye shades and earplugs, because you cannot sleep in a tent without eye shades and earplugs. So I've just gotten habituated to doing that. All these years later, I still do it.
The earplugs were because of the wind?
Yeah, the tents rattling and snapping. It's noisy.
Did you make any significant discoveries when you were, you and your team, when you were away?
Yeah, some of the discoveries we made on the fly, because of when we took our rock samples, we could see they had fingerprints of some things that would told us about the origin of the mountains. So we had figured out by looking at the rocks, the formations that we had sampled, that the mountains had arisen from about 10 miles deep, the ones that we're now towering over us. But then when we got back to the lab, what we did in the lab was we did more chemical tests on the rocks to determine their ages. And the ages were when the mountains were exposed and came up. And what we had expected to find out was that these mountains were created when New Zealand and its plateaus broke away from Gondwana. But in fact, we found out that they were formed 20 million years before then. So they weren't related to that. They were related to something else in plate tectonics. But this is after we've done some lab work. And then the other thing that had came into our radar screen during the time we were there and came back, and it was that there's a whole collection of submarine plateaus in the South Pacific. And New Zealand, in fact, is part of a big, huge plateau, and it's the parts that are sticking up above sea level. And researchers at Texas had, excuse me for a second.
We're speaking with Bruce Leon Dyke, who is the author of Mighty Badland. And he's telling us about his expedition to Antarctica.
So researchers at University of Texas had discovered that these plateaus formed a puzzle group, and that they could all be snugged up against Gondwana, against Antarctica. So I looked at that, and I realized that all these plateaus, including the one that New Zealand's attached to, were pieces of continent, were pieces of Gondwana. But now they formed their own continent. It's scattered around the South Pacific. But it's sunken below sea level. So I had to give it a name. And I called it Zealandia. And if you put all those puzzle pieces back together, they're about the size of India. Hmm. So the question, of course, is why did that take in 1995 to figure that out? And you want the answer?
I'd like it. Yes, we're ending in about 4 minutes.
Okay. The answer is, well, first of all, the plateaus weren't accurately mapped until there was global satellite surveys that, through clever techniques, had mapped the ocean surface, which was deformed by the presence of these plateaus. The plateaus are mapped by satellites scanning over the oceans. And the second reason this hadn't been figured out is because they weren't recognized as pieces of a puzzle that would go back, fit up against Antarctica, including New Zealand, showing that, in fact, these were, even though they're sunken, they're continental. They have continental rocks. So those are the two things that happened in the 90s. And New Zealand now has the advantage of having a vast amount of submarine territory, because it's continental material that's sitting on that extends for hundreds of miles around the nation. So its exclusive economic zone is much bigger than it once thought it had.
Now, we have a very short period, about 3 minutes left. We're speaking with Bruce Lewandowski, the author of Mighty Badland, The Perilous Expedition to Antarctica. Why don't you tell us in the next 2 minutes about your book? Who the audience is?
Why did it take me 30 years to write it? Well, you know, I had a career I was doing, and I wasn't really sure. I wanted to write a popular book because I thought about Antarctica every day, and I was doing it for such a long time. But I wasn't really sure what this expedition taught me personally. And what it did, it taught me that I'm really resilient. I complain like the next person, but I don't quit. I'm not a quitter. I mean, you can't go to Antarctica if you quit. And so I thought, of course, I could write a book. But then I took some writing classes at the local community college and discovered I didn't know how to write. I wrote like a scientist in the passive voice instead of the active voice, like a writer would. So I had to relearn how to write, and that took about 4 years. And I took workshops to help me write. Then I got a professional editor to help me write. And then I got an agent. I had a manuscript that was sufficient that an agent believed in me. And she started shopping it. And then I got feedback from publishers saying, no thanks. And then some of them would give me critiques, and I'd figured out what I had to do. The bottom line of what I had to do was I had to take my urge to distribute the science throughout the book, and I had to move it into a special section in the book where it's all about the science that a layman can read, but the rest of the book is our story, it's our journey. So Mighty Badland is a journey. It's what's called in the popular literature of a hero's journey. You start out, you have a beginning, you have a middle, and you have an end. And it took years to figure that out.
Well, you did, and it's a great, great read. I enjoyed going through it, and I really enjoyed speaking with you this afternoon. Bruce Lewandowski, thank you for being with us on The World of Work.